I was going into the shed, and something spooked him on the other side of the shed, and they bolted, and I got tossed about 25 feet by an ostrich herd. So I was ostracized as well.
Welcome to the Major League Eventing Podcast, the show for eventing fans by eventing fans. Everyone knows how much we love mane and tail. And recently, our little Stanley got a rash under his neck.
Yeah, so right under his collar, he got a rash. He started scratching. It got really, really red. We got worried and we took him to the vet. So as everyone knows, we've talked about before on the show that our Sparky has bad coat and bad skin. He's had allergies his whole life and we've always struggled with that. And now here's Stanley started with us. So we were very worried, took him to the vet, and the vet said, you know what the vet said, Karen?
She said, use mane and tail protect.
Protect line. So here's the deal. You can use protect every day on that hot spot, scratches,
brain rot, ringworm.
Ringworm. So there's directions on the bottle. Get the bottle, but you can use it every day. But the key is you got to let it sit on their coat for about 10 or 15 minutes. Let it really soak in, because that contact is what's going to fix this. And let it dry really well. Don't let the water fester on there. So what we have to do is we have to let Stanley's collar off and let it air out really good. We don't want any moisture, which we think is possibly him running around and creaks and swimming and all types of stuff. You know how the barn dogs are. You have a barn dog at all. So Karen, tell us a little bit more about the Protect 9 shampoo.
So it's a veterinary strength medicated shampoo that that provides a complete cleaning and protection treatment of topical skin problems.
So it's antifungal, antibacterial, does all the above. Mm-hmm. Fantastic stuff.
And it is pH balanced and safe for daily use.
Yeah, so, and that's what I didn't realize, is that we can use it every day to get this stuff cleared up. And we're using it every day. And our dogs are, it's amazing. It's night and day how fast it cleared up. So I would use it, but I would use it like once every week. And it just wasn't enough contact. Right. So get that. And then they also have, for in between baths, you just say you don't have time to give them a bath, topical spray. So they have a Protect 9 spray. It's an anti-wound spray. Really, really fantastic stuff. So Karen, people, how do people learn more?
Just go to maneandtailequine.com.
And get it at your local tech shop, right, Karen?
Yes.
Fairfax and Favor is even good for guys like me, Karen, who are shopping. What's really cool is they have color collections. So they have matching handbags and accessories that go with shoes, all different types of shoes. So for a guy like me who's shopping, it's very simple for me to match up what you have. So your birthday's coming up soon. Just kind of curious if there is some favorite color that you like.
Oh, yeah. I'm obsessed with their mango and cornflower collection right now. Yes, perfect for the summer season.
Yeah, so mangoes kind of looks like a mango color. Mm-hmm. Cornflowers like a baby blue.
Yes.
Super, super cute. And they come with, they have shoes and accessories in all these different colors. So it's very easy to match. And you know, for a guy like me who's not very good at that.
Right. And they also have the trainer with the mango and cornflower stripes.
Yeah, well, that's very cool. So that way, just think about it. You get the trainer with the two different color stripes, and then...
Oh, two different purses.
Exactly. Ooh, so
a mango purse and a cornflower purse.
I'm getting myself in trouble over here.
You sure are.
So Karen, if people want to check mango and cornflower out for themselves and other great Fairfax and Favor products, where do they get?
All they have to do is go to fairfaxandfavor.com.
Triple Crown Feed.
Oh,
Karen.
Yeah.
Triple Crown, big fans of Triple Crown Feed. They have tons of great products out there, mm-hmm. premium stuff. Karen, what do you got to say over there?
So Triple Crown has formulas that are tailored to your horse's unique needs and help support immunity and gut health. Find your local Triple Crown Feed dealer by going to triplecrownfeed.com.
Triplecrownfeed.com. That's a little bit of a tongue twister.
It is.
Triplecrownfeed.com. They have a great feed locator. They have a great feed comparison tool on their website. I encourage everyone to get over there. Check out Triple Crown Feed's website. Check out the different products. Check out what makes them so special. And give them a shot, right, Karen?
Oh, yeah.
Support the people to support the show. The Rain Turtle by Turtleneck. The best rain sheet on the market, Karen.
The best. It comes in a 1, 2, and a 3 piece with a 3-year waterproof warranty. And it has a full antibacterial lining.
Yeah, fantastic. Of course, they have the stretch panels. So, Karen, if people want to learn more, learn about the rain turtle, the sizing, how to measure your horse up for sizing, how do people learn more and purchase the rain turtle by Turtleneck?
Just go to turtleneck.biz.
Trish Scott's got us covered, and she can cover you. Trish is on with us to talk about equine mortality and medical coverages, which there's a lot of changes, Trish. So tell us, what's going on in the industry right now, and how can you help people?
Yeah, there's a lot of changes going on in the equine mortality and medical coverage right now, and I just wanted to put the word out there that we don't have to be afraid. Changes are coming. Right now, the biggest one is Great American is not offering any medical coverage to any renewals or new business. But, and the thing is with our Venters, they're the one of the top three rated horses for, for mortality. So it's a very unique breed of animal, very unique training. So we need to make sure that your policy is covered. I have access to some of the top rated carriers right now. They are all offering full mortality, medical, surgical, any coverage is needed for our Venters. Don't worry about it. Just give me a call. I'll be more than happy to walk through your current policy and make sure that your renewal is covering your horse. Not a problem. Just give me a call. I'm always available. 484-319-8923.
This episode is brought to you by Red & Goat Equestrian. To learn more about Red & Goat, visit their Facebook and Instagram pages and go to redandgoatequestrian.com.
I'm Rob.
And I'm Karen. And Rob's super excited about today's guest.
Yes, ma'am.
We have been fans of this guest for a long time.
Yes.
Welcome to the show, 5-star eventer, Michael Pollard.
Thank you. Very good to be on.
And he's a Pan Am Gold Medalist,
yeah,
Karen.
Yeah, so
I don't know. I mean, I get all
can't
nervous.
Forget that.
I kind of, Karen introduced me to the sport of eventing, and you were at the top of the sport in those days, when I was learning, 15, 20 years ago, you were really, coming on strong. So I was a big fan of you early on, because whoever was at the top of the sport back then, that's who I was learning the sport of eventing from watching. Mm-hmm. So very cool to finally get a chance to talk to you. And we've never met in person, so this is going to be fun, Karen.
Yeah, it is.
We're flying without a neck, Karen.
Watch out.
So, Michael, we always like to find out, eventers and people in the sport are always traveling around the country. So could you tell us where you're coming to us from?
Montana today. I'm actually about 7 miles, I think, from Rebecca Farm currently. I don't have anything official to do at the event, but we're happy it's going on this weekend, and I'll probably get to be a spectator if nothing else.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Yeah, so we're going to talk a little bit more about mm-hmm. why you're there too, because it's kind of interesting. So it's like, oh, Michael's up, and he's there for the big event. No, he's, well, we'll get into it a little later. It's a real estate mogul, Karen. So, yeah. He's traded in eventing and being broke for actually making a living where you can eat steak once in a while.
Definitely trying to anyway.
Yeah, for sure. So Karen, what do you say we get after this?
Yeah, let's do it. So Michael, can you take us back and tell us how you got your start in riding and then into eventing?
Yeah, if I can remember that long ago. I started riding actually when I was 12 years old. I'd asked for horses for Christmas for a long time. I was always really interested in horses. But we lived in a neighborhood, so it wasn't really something that was going to be possible at the time. But my dad sent me to summer camp a couple years in a row in Tuxedo, North Carolina. And the summer camp had horses there. And the first year I was kind of exposed. Really, when I went to the camp, the horses were the most interesting thing that I was. I liked doing all kinds of things, but that was really what I was most excited about. And then I came first year out. 2 or 3 weeks, and I begged if I could ride, and my dad said no. So the next year I went to camp instead of the 2 weeks, I went for 6 weeks. And the next year I begged again if I could ride. And by the last year, I spent the entire summer at camp, and I had convinced the counselors to beg my dad to ask him if I could ride when I came home. And so the third year finally stuck. I guess that was, I was 12 by then. And I came back home to Greenville, South Carolina, and I started taking riding lessons then after that. So a local eventing barn in Greenville, South Carolina.
Wow. So was the eventing just by chance that you landed in at an eventing barn, or was that like specific, you were into the sport?
Yeah, it was a little bit by chance. I mean, the top riders there, it was like it was a big deal to go beginner, novice, and novice. It was an eventing kind of focus barn, and that there was, I guess it was really considered combined training focus then. So more local shows. They had a lot of school horses for people learning to ride. Shout out to McConnell, who was my first riding instructor. And she really had me, all three phases essentially pretty early on, but a lot of the people there also did hunter jumpers and did other things other than just eventing, but eventing was kind of what everybody aspired to do there. I did try pure dressage shows, some small hunter shows, but the first time I went cross country, I knew that's what I wanted to do. So,
wow. And did you own a horse at that time, or were you using like a school horse?
I was using a school horse most of the time. And then, we went and bought several, we tried a couple of horses that, I had a saddlebred cross for a little while. There's a funny story there where my saddlebred cross was pretty nice. And my dad decided we didn't want to keep them. We had a little farm that we had that we were keeping for a client of his, keeping up. And we had ostriches on the farm, and he decided we're going to move our horses to the ostrich farm. And we were not very savvy horse owners at the time. And I don't know if you ever had seen horses and ostriches together, but they don't make very good bedfellows. And I don't think when we moved them to the farm, I think they were there for 3 months. And I don't think we could ever actually get on them the entire time that they were there, because they were so afraid of the ostriches that, you'd go to put your foot in and they would bolt. And they probably weren't that calm to start with. But then we said that they got ostracized, and they did. They were never really the same. We bought horses from a lady that I can't remember now, but we bought horses from a lady that would trade them if they didn't work out. So we had to go through a couple of different trades to find something that would work. But then I had a quarter horse that I rode in my first actual recognized event, Palomino quarter horse. That was my start to eventing in Aiken at, I think it was Copeland.
So the horses were ostracized. Note to self,
yes.
The things we learn on the show.
horses and ostriches do not go together.
Yeah, imagine that. That's
look, I can't say that I was, that I understood how to fix horse issues. And if you thought of it like a snowball down the hill in horse training, I was not in any way capable of slowing a snowball from getting way out of control at that stage in my life. So who knows if it would still be as big a problem today, but certainly horses and ostriches in my experience don't mix well.
That's crazy. Did you work with ostriches much? Like I've seen, and I know this is off the rails, but did you ever do like the tube sock over your hand and like grab the ostrich by the head and all that? Like I heard that's like really the only way you can like work with an ostrich.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to cover their eyes. That's true, and then they become quite docile. No, I did not do that. I was at the time. I must have been I was right around 12 still. So I was still fairly young. I have a couple of fond memories. No, fond is not the right word. I did get trampled by a herd of ostriches once.
Oh.
That's one of my that's one of the fun facts about me. They were 6 month old. They were 6 months old at the time, and I'd gone in to feed them. The males get very aggressive as they get older. But at 6 months, you can't really tell the difference. They're all pretty, they were probably like at the top of their chest, they were probably 3 feet tall, and they were like 6 feet tall with the neck. So they seem like they're pretty easygoing, but they spook really easily. And then they ran together in a pack, and when I was feeding them, my dad put me in there, and they get essentially what looks like horse feed. So my dad sent me in there to feed them in their trough, and I was going into the shed, and something spooked him on the other side of the shed, and they bolted, and I got tossed about 25 feet by an ostrich herd. So I was ostracized as well.
Oh, near death experience by ostrich. Oh. That's the first on the yes. show. That is.
I can tell you the business, it was meant to be a business and the business wasn't successful. He probably won't be happy that I'm even mentioning it, because he still has a little bit of PTSD from that particular business venture. And we only talk about it if it's at Christmas and he's in a good mood already.
Dad's got to be in the right mood to hear about the ostriches.
Yeah,
that's funny. So, so you traded a couple horses. That's kind of actually really nice that you found a place that would actually work with you and kind of cycle in horses until you found the right fit.
Yeah, we were a bad business, I'm sure. You look back on the things you did when you first get into it. I'm sure all professionals have the same thing. You think, how did I ever make it out of that stage? And I'm sure that we were the worst class. She probably was just happy that we finally went away.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that a lot of times, and what we're learning through these interviews over the years is, you know, I mean, obviously there's some top riders that were brought up in horse families and they were, you know, from you know, their whole life they were riding and had top instructions. But then there were people like you who you really took the long way or learned the hard way for sure. So were you a natural at it?
For sure.
Were you a natural at riding at least, or were you kind of not even that great of a rider?
I did a lot of sports and I was always pretty athletic and I was kind of the right size to do horses. And certainly, you know, I don't know that I was, when I first started, I don't know that you could tell that I was a lot better than anybody else, but I progressed more quickly and was more serious about it than probably anybody else. You know, there are a couple of good students. And so I always wanted to do what they were doing, like really, really quickly. And it was really important to me that I, you know, got to jump bigger. And, you know, I'm sure I drove my trainer crazy. Because I always if I didn't feel like I made, like, if I didn't have like some noticeable improvement in my lesson, then I was, you know, unhappy with myself. And I always wanted to try to see if I could jump 4 feet and then 4'3" and then 4'6". And I didn't have any real business jumping 2 feet. So, you know, I was really serious about improvement. And I think that I took it like really seriously from the very beginning, because my dad was a, you know, a strength coach and coached football and had been like drilling me on baseball. So I kind of already had, already knew how hard you had to work at it, but I had never get good at something, but I didn't ever have something that I was actually interested in. You know, it's kind of my dad's passions and not my passions. So, once I had that kind of work ethic applied to something that I was actually really passionate about, then it did go pretty quickly.
Wow. Hmm. So you were self-driven right off the get-go. Like, you knew you just wanted to be good. You were just a naturally competitive person. That's
Yes. Yeah, I was. I didn't see the pathway to being like a really good rider. My trainer was a big fan of both Jimmy Wofford and Denny Emerson. And there was a Denny Emerson clinic that was coming through, and I'd almost gotten to the point where I was going to stop riding, because I didn't know where I was going with it. I loved it, but I was like, it was just kind of like, I felt like I'd kind of plateaued and I didn't see like a future. I didn't know what I was going to do. And she asked me to go to a Denny Emerson clinic, and then that like completely changed my outlook. And Denny was really gracious and invited me to his farm in the summer, and also sort of, you know, talked to me afterward and said, look, you know, you're really talented. If you wanted to be an Olympian, like, you could be an Olympian. And that wasn't even like, to think that anybody could even like, to even think that you could go intermediate seemed completely inconceivable from where I was from. So for someone that had been to the, you know, been to the World Games and won a medal, and to tell you that, you know, you were good enough to be an Olympian at that age, it like made all the difference and really completely changed my frame of reference of what was possible. And so that was what that became my goal.
Wow. So. How old were you at that time?
I guess I was, it seems like it all happened really quickly. I guess I was like 13, because I rode with Denny that summer when I was 13, and I was doing, by then he kind of got me, had been doing novice. I got a thoroughbred off the track. Well, it wasn't off the track. It had been taken off the track like 5 or 6 months before that. when I realized that the quarter horse had kind of reached its peak. We sold the quarter horse. We used that money to buy a little thoroughbred that was off the track, that had already been in a little bit of eventing training. And then that was kind of, it was right when I had that horse that I met Denny. Denny, like, I was having some struggles with it. He, like, in like 10 minutes, he got on it and fixed all the problems that I had. So I was like, wow, like, this is much better. And I was like, maybe I should learn to do that. And so when I went to his place, I was kind of already doing novice level, I think. And then I did a full season of training with him, kind of getting help both in Southern Pines and Vermont. And then I must have done like 15 or 20 trainings that year. And then I did a prelim, my first prelim on that same horse when I was 14. So it seemed, now when I think, when I look back on it, it seems like it all happened really fast. But at the time, it seemed like it was taking forever. So,
wow. So at 14, so all of a sudden Denny kind of talent spotted you. Isn't that crazy, Karen, when you think of somebody went from, hey, I might just leave the sport because it's not going well and it's not in here. Just that right moment in time.
The right person and the right moment.
That's amazing. So when you're listening at home, don't give up. You know, that next opportunity that might be life-changing is right around the corner. It's incredible. Did you stay with Denny the whole time? Or did you, like, did you stay with him? How long did that go?
No, I would go up. I went up, so I think I went three or four summers to his place in Vermont. And at the time, that was like one of the places to go as a working student. And so working student where they worked half the day and they still paid board but they got their lessons for free. But I couldn't afford to pay the board at that point either. So he let me work a full day, and I think I can't remember what it cost, but like we didn't really have to pay that much. You know, I kind of had, by then I wasn't going to camp or anything. So I had the summers to myself, and my dad had custody of me. So he was happy that I was gone for a little while, as long as I was doing something productive. So I really just spent the whole time in the summers, and then I really kind of went without a whole lot of formal instruction. I definitely had some trainers when I came home, but you know, it was very sporadic, and I really got all my instruction in the summers with Denny. So, and then I remember going. It's all a blur at this stage, but I remember I did go to Southern Pines quite a bit because I was in. By this time, I think I'd moved to Tryon, North Carolina, and I remember going to some. Week long, or basically every break, I tried to go train with him. And then at one stage, my dad even let me move to Southern Pines and live with another family there and train with him during the school year. I completely ruined that because I was not very well behaved, and Denny kicked me out and told me never to talk to him again.
Wow.
which is exactly what I needed, to be honest, because I was terrible. But truth is painful. Yeah. But it was bad. Yeah, I was very I went from the time I was probably like 17, 18, I went through a really rebellious stage. My dad was really strict, and it's not his fault, but he also gave me genes of being stubborn and liking to party, I guess, at that age in my life anyway. And so Denny had it was the only sensible thing to do is to kick me out. But that was the truth. Yeah. It was bad.
Wow. Did you guys ever make amends, or does he still hate your guts?
Oh yeah. No. When he realized that I'd come through it on the other side, and I was actually a pretty good guy now, and that what he saw in me, I had actually fulfilled. He forgave me. Oh. we became good friends again. but it took a lot of soul searching from him, because I certainly, again, he was very good to me, and I definitely deserved the treatment. So, but you know, sometimes these things are what. Are you know, we all have to learn how to grow up, and you know, my dad had sort of been my guiding light on basically everything. And when I was trying to become you know, an adult on my own, I stumbled through that pretty heavily. Hopefully, you know, I've got four kids of my own, so I'm hoping that I'm sure I will be repaid for these things. I'm hoping not, but it's likely, unfortunately.
Oh no, a little bit of payback. Wow, that's crazy. Well, thanks for sharing that, because a lot of people would have kept that part. You know, they want to keep the pristine, you know, persona up. So after getting kicked out there, now,
well, too many people know.
They're going to call you out on your BS if you didn't mention it.
Yeah. I trust me. I wish that was the only time I had problems. I got better for a while. I ebbed and flowed, unfortunately.
Oh man. So now from there, did you decide, all right, I'm going to be a professional. This is full-time life. And
yeah, it didn't really happen so much like that. It was more, you know, I went to England for 2 years. So I guess when I was 16, I'd had, you know, with Denny's help, I had a bunch of, I realized that my little thoroughbred wasn't going to be able to go past intermediate level. I'd done well at a couple of intermediates. I was planning to go to Radnor and what was then the 2-star. And I was thinking maybe I'd go to Young Riders, and my little horse was wonderful for what I needed at the time, but I had kind of outgrown what his capabilities were. And I needed to try to move to the next level. And so my father was a personal trainer at this stage and had a number of clients that, and you know, he basically would train people and then they would talk the whole time. And my dad, but his favorite subject at the time, especially, was to talk about how great I was. And a number of those people decided that, you know, from talking to him that I did have a chance to go to the Olympics, and they wanted to help me to do that. So in Greenville, South Carolina, they put together a sponsor party for me, and we raised about $60,000 to buy the next horse, the next horse that could do a little bit more. And then from those meetings, I met each individually with all the people that had been to the sponsor party. And we also got, another really good owner, or actually two really good owners out of that, out of those meetings. So I ended up with, I bought a couple of horses from who's become a lifelong friend, Alec Lahore in England. And we ended up buying three horses over there with him over a period of 2 years. And I went over and rode with him for about 2 6-month stays when I was 18 and 19 in 98 and 99 after pulling all those sponsorship things together. So pretty cool. When I look back on that too, it seems crazy. But really cool period of my life. To get to go and compete in England and you know, the Lahore family, Hugh still works at Chattahoochee Hills now and is a integral part of the U.S. Sport, but his brother Alec has organized the Olympics and all kinds of other huge things as an organizer, which when we were all young and I was living in England, you'd never guess that we'd all end up doing okay, because it was a little bit of a circus. But here we all survived.
Wow. So could you fast forward to eventually you went and got the Pan Am gold medal. Can you maybe take us through that before we kind of get up to current day?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, during that whole England experience, all that time, I thought that I would be, I didn't go to school, didn't go to college. I thought that I was going to be an Olympian in the next year when I was 18. And it took however long, to even make a team, another 10 or 12 years. And, I was capable of doing the level, but I wasn't really very good yet. And it really took focusing on the dressage and the show jumping for 3 or 4 years when I was at Bucart Farm, and getting the help I needed to not just be adequate at the level, but to be you know good enough to train horses to win at that level. Then I had a number of really good horses. When Natalie and I were married, and the kind of the stars aligned pretty well. And I won a couple of big competitions leading up to the Pan Am Games, and got selected with a mare that we'd actually bought for Natalie. And then she got pregnant, so I got the ride during that period of time when she was not able to ride anymore. And that was right around the Pan Am game time. So I did a quick last minute qualifier, and then I won the final selection trial. So all of a sudden I was selected, and I didn't know the mare very well, but Honey was a extremely talented, not the fastest, but very good on the flat, very good show jumper, and very honest cross country. And I got to go to the Pan Am Games, and you know, those people that were on the Pan Am Games team with me are still some of my best friends. I mean, they're all different types of experiences that people will talk about when it comes to team situations. But that, Buck was our anchor in that team and kind of did the captain's role. And all of us on that team are still very, very close. And I couldn't have asked for. He still tells me it's his favorite team, but he's going to tell me that maybe. But I really think that it was something special. You know, like I don't think that year especially, everyone kind of thought that Canada was going to win, and everyone did a personal best, and the horses all came through beautifully, and a lot of that had to do with that it was a really tight team. And you think, well, what does that matter to what is essentially an individual sport? But it definitely raised everyone's game. So it was a great experience, and I'm still, still really proud to have done that. And there were a lot of things I wish before I decided that it was time to end my career. I wish I would have been able to do a few things that were on my bucket list. I really wanted to do badminton. I would have liked to have done a few more what are now 5 stars. But that's a huge highlight for me and still something I'm proud of.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty cool. Star-studded team. Who was all in that squad with you?
Oh, I don't remember the other people, just Buck. No,
I'm pretty sure all of them have been on our guests before, right,
Ken? Yeah.
The whole
squad's
been.
I think all but one.
Shannon Lilly, Hannah Sue Burnett, Buck Davidson, and Lynn Szymanski.
Yeah.
We haven't had Shannon on.
Not yet.
We got to get Shannon on.
Yeah.
Look for that soon.
Shannon's great.
Shannon, we're going to be calling. Got to get the rest of that squad on. what a squad. That's really, 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 really cool. So if you take us up like between that, that was 2011. Now here we are 2022. And then you've kind of, you're not really competing anymore or anything like that. Can you take us through like what happened after the Pan Ams and what current day is like?
Yeah, I'll do the 30,000 foot view. What happened? So I was really trying to gear up for the London Olympics after that, and I had a really bad horse trailer accident right after one of the selection trials for London, and unfortunately, some of my best horses were killed. The ones that were in contention for the Olympics were killed in that horse trailer accident, and then the next 3 or 4 years. I had basically built my whole life to have some businesses that allowed me not to have owners, and then I felt pretty great about being able to have a family and have the horses and not really necessarily having to answer to anybody on how I did things. And that allowed me to, if I needed to take time for the family, I could. And that's, I'm not saying you can't do it another way, but that's just the way that I had chosen to do it. And I was really happy with that. And then after the trailer accident, people really wanted to help me, which was awesome. And I got so focused on trying to get back there that I lost sight of, why I had done it the way I'd done it to start with. And I really focused on like trying to get more horses and getting owners and I had lost a lot of, I lost a lot of capital in the horses that I had, and they were my friends, and I was so fixated on not being beaten by that situation that I started doing it in a way that probably wasn't very smart for the way that I needed to live. and was not probably in the best interest of my family. And I had amazing owners, so it's nothing against them. I mean, Christine Turner is still Boyd's, all of those great 4 and 5 star horses that he has with her are, she's a fantastic owner, if not one of the best in the country. Like, she was one of my owners that really helped pull me out of those dark days. So it's not her fault, but it was a different level of commitment, and I had to do the things that the owners want you to do, and they are perfectly it's perfectly legitimate for them to ask you to do those things. But I was sitting at the Fairhill Young Horse Championships in 2015, and it was like raining and miserable, and I didn't have a horse in the main class. But I was there for the young horses, for owners, and I had a couple horses in the 3 star, but I wasn't really quite sure. I didn't really think they were quite ready, and they didn't go that great. And I'm sitting there in the pouring rain, and my kids called me because it was right around Halloween, and they were calling me about going trick or treating, and I was missing it, and I was like, I just hung up the phone, kind of like half in tears, and I was like, man, I'm never doing this again. Like, I love the sport, but I have lost the plot if I'm going to miss out on my kids growing up, and that was in October of 2015, and I had sold every horse and all my stuff by January of the following year, and I still did a couple of last competitions with the owners that I had horses until I could get them to other riders. And that was kind of how it ended for me. It had been kind of a problem because my kids had been calling me about, or had been asking me why I was gone so much. They were just getting to the age where they noticed that I wasn't there. And when we were in Florida, it wasn't so bad because I could go to a competition, I could come back, and I was still at home at night. In the non-Florida season, it was really difficult to not be gone all the time. And it was affecting everything. It was affecting all my relationships. So I just decided that, as much as I loved it, I really struggled because I was like, man, I didn't get to the Olympics. I didn't do all the things I wanted to do. And then I kind of, I was sitting there. I was like, well, what was, like, my goal really was to be the best rider. Like, and while, probably everybody has disagreements on who that was or when that is, I felt very comfortable that I had at least achieved what I wanted to achieve when I was a kid. And like, I just got comfortable with that. And I felt really comfortable that, that I had done everything I needed to do to be, to feel like that I hadn't let myself down, and that I could probably go to the Olympics if I spent 20 more years trying, but I was going to lose things that were much more important to me if I did that. And, that's not to say that other people don't have that same issue. Just the way that things had worked out for me, I just couldn't continue to, I felt like I had become pretty selfish, and I needed to change my life in order to do the right thing by my kids. And my father had been so generous with his time towards me. I just wasn't going to miss that time with my kids. And that's really what it boiled down to.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's really incredible. And you said the word right there, selfish. Like, not too long ago, I kind of wrote a little something, and I said, eventers at the top of the sport, they have to be selfish. I think, Boyd has said it in plain English that he has to be selfish with, his time priorities and things like that. And even he does a really good job of balancing with the kids and all that. But there's times when, you have to be number one in the barn and, put things like that. So that's incredible. Wow. Right there at Fairhill.
Yeah, well, it was also doubly difficult for me because, I had work responsibilities that I had built businesses in order to ride horses. Like, that was explicitly what I had tried to do. But then when it's one thing if horses are your business, but it wasn't set up that way for me. I had horses so that they kind of broke even, but ultimately, that's not where I was making money. So I wasn't even supporting my family that way. So it became really hard for me to explain how. Wow. You're not, how am I not home? And I'm not, what I'm doing is not actually supporting family. Cause I actually, like, there was just no way for me to justify it to myself. And I just had to stop. And, I'm perfectly willing to admit that I was addicted to horses to a certain way, in the very best way. I mean, look, horses took me all over the world. I love all of my horses like their family. I had wonder, like they taught me so much about work ethic and business. And I mean, all there was not one moment that I would want to change. But it just, you know, I had to move on. I had other responsibilities that were at that stage more important.
Wow. Mm. Incredible. Now, was Tester Leg one of your horses at the time?
Yes. Yep. He was actually one of the ones I had at Fairhill in the what is now 3-star. I got him and also On Cue. I didn't have On Cue as long. I just had her long enough to kind of work on some of the flat work and some of the jumping. And I don't even remember if I may have competed her. I don't even remember, to be honest. But Thomas, I did. I think I competed for 2 years. I took him from training through like winning at an intermediate level.
Wow. Did you know those two horses were going to go on to be as special as they are?
At that stage of my life, I didn't have horses in the barn that I didn't think were going to be great. You never know. Thomas, I didn't, when he first came, I didn't think he was going to be great at all, to be quite frank. Cause he just didn't seem to jump that well. But he really was brave, and he had a really athletic type. And it was when he started going prelim and his first couple intermediates, I thought, you know what, this horse really has something. But I didn't know what that meant exactly. I just, you know, you don't really know until you test them. And he really would like look for the flags, in a way that, you know, only 10% even of good horses do. And he also was very, very trainable and like worked hard every single day. And those are pretty great qualities. And On Cue was super, super talented, and was super brave. But, you know, I really didn't have enough time with her to know whether or not how great she would be. I remember her when Sinead got her as a young horse. I remember thinking like, that is the nicest horse in the country. There was some injury issues or back issues or whatever. And Christine sent her to me to kind of get her going again in Florida. And I remember riding her and thinking, you know, there's a really not the horse that I remember is in here, but she's just a little bit gummed up for whatever reason. I was really happy when she started going so well, because I always thought that she was just incredible. I had a very small part to play in those horses, and I'm proud of that. But Boyd deserves all the credit, because you know he's done an incredible job. I never would have thought that. I mean, what he's done with those two horses is certainly more than I've thought they would have done.
Wow! Yeah, On Cue, 5-star champion.
Yeah, yeah,
it's incredible when you have two of those horses like that, and you're like, you have a string like that, and you're saying, oh my gosh, like how do you pick?
Yeah, yeah.
What is the top?
Yeah, yeah. I had a really good one, Ballingall and Pizzazz, that went on to do young riders and did really well at 3-star level. And I still had Honey going. So, you know, had I known they were going to be so good, it would have been a lot harder to quit. So maybe that's why it was better that I didn't.
Yeah, if you had a crystal ball, like, sometimes things might not be better. What's current day like for you? So I mentioned like you have real estate, you know, a mogul. He's a mogul, Karen.
Mogul.
What's your activity with
horses? I don't
know
if you can say that.
Before I forget, you know, we know you're still involved with horses, but maybe you could take us through that. And also, we just want to say thank you to our friends at Ride IQ.
Yes.
Because you're also a Ride IQ coach. So maybe you could take us through, you know, what you've done with Ride IQ and then what your current, you know, horse and what your current life is like.
I haven't done nearly enough with Ride IQ. I've been so busy that I haven't gotten all of my lessons in, but I have just bought a small horse farm. So, I'm thinking that I will have more horses to ride soon and I will get more Ride IQs done. But I think that's a really cool service. And, you know, Kyle was a good friend of mine, Kyle Carter, and he asked me to do it some time ago. But then when I heard about this, I heard some of them myself, and I just think it's cool. I can imagine, you know, riding and listening to some of those, and even like some of the hack ones are really cool. So, I think it's a great, service, and I'm happy that they think highly enough of me that they want me to do them. So, But I've got to get more of them done. Because if you just were trying to use mine at the moment, you'd be pretty bored.
Well, it's nice to know that there's more stuff coming that, you know, for people listening that, hey, the library isn't full. Yeah. We're still growing.
So. Yeah. I've been thinking about, it'd be kind of cool to do, to get a really quality off the track thoroughbred and do, almost like a training blog, with how I would retrain, like a thoroughbred horse like that. We've done a couple of those recently where I've helped a student of mine, Bree Robinette, get some nice young horses and, it's amazing how you can get really good quality still, but I mean, there's some really difficult things that all those horses have to go through now I've had a lot of experience with that, with retraining of how to jump better and retraining the flat work. And, I think there's probably, as I do this stuff in the future, I think I'm going to try to do a series like that where it's step by step rather than the last ones I did were kind of more training specific movements, which is still pretty useful, I think. But I think doing a series would be kind of cool. So I'm hoping that the right horse, somebody will want me to train one, and then I can do the right IQs as I retrain one. So, and I haven't had a place to put horses before, but I'm just in the process of finalizing a deal to buy a little 30-acre farm with 5 stalls, and we're going to put a couple arenas in. And I'm hoping all the equestrian training that I do, that I've been doing kind of in and around Atlanta and Chattanooga, I'm going to focus on just having it all at my own place there. And again, not trying to travel less and spend more time with the family.
Wow. So it sounds like breaking news, Karen.
Yeah, I do like that idea.
He's back in the eventing business.
I do like the idea with the vlogging, the retraining of a off-track thoroughbred. I like that.
Yeah, because they have a lot of the same issues, there's anybody that's retraining them, people have all different types of ideas, but I've had a number of them come through and not just be good horses, but end up being great horses. And I still love, I know the sport a lot, and there's, you need really good movement. You need really good jumping, which requires, some Irish sport horse or some warm blood. But still a lot of my best horses and the ones that I love the most are pure thoroughbreds. So, yeah.
Well, and that's doing a good service because there's so many thoroughbreds that, good ones out there that they just need a chance to have quality, upbringing and people that need the help. And even if they don't become top horses, but for that type of information to help people, I think is huge, and it's going to help people, horses, and it can only do good for keeping these thoroughbreds, being productive members of society. So I think that's a fantastic.
Yeah, there's a ton of really talented, good moving, beautiful thoroughbred horses. The problem is they're just, a lot of them are scary when you start. you have to get through that. Yep. And there are a lot of ways to make that easier, but the average person just retraining horses, unless you know what you're doing, or have good help, it can be a little bit of a daunting task. But there are so many nice horses that that end up not having a job that have so much more to give and would be such great event horses. I love to do that still, and it's really cool when you see one that was not, that no one really thought much of, turn around and be really awesome. So
that's really cool. And what other, you mentioned you had like a student, like what's your role in horses day to day now?
So I try to be really good about time management on a large level. I'm not the best at keeping myself on track. So I try to really be diligent about not overdoing anything, because it's my nature to overdo everything. And so I try to keep 10 hours of horse training and lessons per week. A lot of that time now is spent with Bree, who her family has been really great for me and great for my daughter and my family. So it's really important to me that they get the time, first part of my attention. And then I do probably a clinic I'd say on average about once every 6 to 8 weeks on top of that. So it's sort of 10 hours a week during the week. And then, you know, a full weekend clinic sort of once every 6 to 8 weeks. That's the limit of what I can do horse wise.
Gotcha. And then you said your daughter, she's riding, and can you tell us a little bit about,
yes.
Is she an up and comer? What's going on there? Future Olympian?
Well, she's just done her first couple of recognized events. She's 12 years old. So she thinks she wants to be, you know, an Olympian. So I said, slow down. Let's just enjoy riding. So, but, you know, she's got it everywhere in her genes between, you know, Carl and Natalie, who's obviously a top young rider. And then her grandfather, Carl, went to the Olympics for Belgium a couple of times. And then I was a professional rider. So it's not surprising that one of our four kids really loves horses. But, you know, her mom really didn't want her to ride that much. You know, she did 3 or 4 years of essentially riding bareback, even in some shows at their farm there in Chatsworth, Georgia, the old North Georgia showgrounds. And then she has, you know, rode stick horses around every single day, doing Grand Prix dressage tests and jumping up to 3.5-4 feet, and like took stick horses, you know, to the top of the mountains that we hike in Montana. I mean, it's like, I've never seen anybody want it more than that. So finally she's convinced everyone to relent and let her to ride horses. So here we are now looking at getting a little farm. So the horses will split time on the farm with the boys and their motorcycles. So we'll see if that goes any better than the ostriches did.
Yeah, horses and motorcycles. Gotta get the, like, horses and ostriches. Nice.
Yeah.
That's really, really cool.
Yeah, it is.
Awesome.
Right. It's a joy, you know. It's a joy to see your child do something they really love. And then, you know, it's so crazy because, you know, you watch her. If I watch her ride now, I try not to be the teacher. I want to be the dad, and I let Bree teach her. And but it's amazing how you can see, you know, I remember watching her mom so many years and helping her when she needed stuff. And it's like a crazy melding of our two riding styles without teaching her anything. It's like just how she naturally rides, and it's so nuts to watch it. So it's a joy, you know, and hopefully she'll keep wanting to do it for a little while. And if she does, that's awesome. And if she decides she doesn't want to do it, that's totally fine with me. Either one, as long as she's happy.
And so Rebecca's going on right now, or getting ready to kick off. So are you guys going to take a cruise over there? Does she get to watch a little bit?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'll never get out of taking her there. I'll have to take her there. She's very persistent.
Very cool. Awesome. I love it.
All right. So, Michael, we're going to have a little bit of fun. We are going to play
quick fire questions.
And quick fire questions is brought to you by Red and Goat Equestrian. Get your all weather outerwear by going to redandgoatequestrian.com.
Hey-o.
So, it's just five random questions. You don't have to be quick, but we will grade you at the end.
Okay, perfect.
All right. So, you ready?
Yep.
Okay. Got a little bit of music in the background. All right. So, favorite rider growing up?
Mark Todd.
Very good. That's a good one. All right. What was your favorite event to compete at?
I loved Groton House. I remember going across, like watching the first like Olympic selection trial I ever watched was at Groton House. And watching David O'Connor and Bruce Davidson, like those horses were, I think it was even Eagle Lion, and it was Karen on like Biko, David on Gilt Edge, and I'm probably remembering all that wrong, but that's the way I remember it. And it was like watching them jump huge fences across lanes and all the people there, and just like that setting of New England, it felt like England itself. Like it was amazing, and really inspired me at the time.
Yeah, very that's cool. Awesome. All right. Well, we heard about the ostrich stampede, but what is another thing about you that most people don't know?
Love to ski. That was actually, if I hadn't been a professional rider, I wanted to be a professional skier. My dad moved me to Colorado when I was six, and you know, we took like a 2-year sabbatical. He had a a gym business where he was owner of a gym, but he shoveled snow for two winters. And I learned to ski when I was, I think I was 6 and 7 those 2 years. And we would go back every year and love to ski. The only thing I ever loved more than skiing was horses. And that was really, I had the same kind of feeling skiing as I did with riding horses. But I loved the relationship with the horse. And so, horses were always my favorite, but, a very, very close second is snow skiing.
Wow. Okay. That's awesome.
Yeah. All right. If eventing was not an option for you, what other riding discipline would you have wanted to try?
Show jumping for sure.
Yeah, good.
I still think I'll come back and be a show jumper, although I'm sure show jumpers would laugh because I'm not good enough. I still think I could jump in the Grand Prix, and I'd love to do it someday. I don't know how that would ever happen at this stage, but the amount of time that it, I mean, I know any top discipline takes about the same amount of time because it's super hard work. But it feels to me like it would be more possible to show jump a little bit higher level than it would be possible to do eventing in my life now, just because of the number of fitness hours and things that you have to put in and trying to get all the disciplines done. I know that's very naive, because if I actually wanted to jump at a high level, when I tried it, I would realize very quickly that I better spend a lot more time practicing. But that's my unrealistic fantasy. Then I'll come back and do some Grand Prix show jumping.
There you go. Oh, yeah. All right. So last question. If you could ride any horse, past, present, or fiction, who would it be?
I really miss my horse. The best feeling I ever had in cross country was to ride Jude's Law. Our time together was cut way too short. I would love to ride Jude's Law around badminton. That would have been a dream. Wow. I think that would have been the kind of horse you could win that event on. And that was really, like, I grew up watching badminton tapes and watched every single one of them until the tape wouldn't work anymore. That would, if I could redo anything, it would be having that horse back and trying to get him to a badminton.
Yeah. Wow.
Well,
good answer.
Yeah.
Good answer.
Well
overall, what do you think? Fantastic job.
Good job.
A plus.
All right.
Super job.
Crowd goes wild.
The crowd.
I got all of them right. That's good.
Yes, you got them all right.
You're correct. You answered everyone correctly. That was the correct answer. Hey, may I ask one question? So you mentioned, what are your businesses? You say you have multiple businesses and things. I'm just always curious on what people do. What do you do?
My wife and I have several vacation rentals. That's why we're in Montana now. We have a property here. We've built, we bought a house here. We've fixed up a couple of others, and then we converted a barn/garage into another house. So we've got some rentals in Whitefish, Montana. I did some developing of a couple of properties in Chattanooga, Tennessee that I've sold most of now. And I have a couple of big industrial buildings in Dalton that I've rented out and have now sold. So I did some property management, some of both commercial and we really like vacation properties. But some of the industrial stuff we've sold and then I still have my dad and I do a horse arena business called Future Track, and we still build. Business has been crazy. They're really, really good. We probably build 20 to 25 arenas a year. High end, vertical drain or sealed base, arenas, all weather surfaces. We started that business by screwing up our own so many times because we were too cheap to get somebody else to do it. So we would do it ourselves. And every time we'd screw it up. So we learned how to not screw it up finally after. I think my last one that we built was finally good. And now I see 20 a year that are perfect, and I'm always annoyed that they get the nicer rings than I never did. So we do that. That's been a great business for my dad and I to do together. And those are the main things I still do. I still do the horses to a certain extent, although much less than before. And that's kind of it for now. But I've operated and run and started a number of carpet related chemical businesses, and I got into footing really because I saw that the carpet industry had a lot of really good footing products that we could manufacture and make into arena products. So I've always kind of been through my involvement with Carl and the Bucar family. I'd always kind of known about the carpet industry now, and so I still have some really good contacts in that industry. And I'm always looking for the next kind of opportunity. I've been in and out of and started probably 15 or 20 businesses at this stage. So I kind of serially look for what I think is a good opportunity. And I'd been involved in the Cavalier horse feed, brought that to the States or helped bring it to the States and started their manufacturing, and then sold my piece. So I'm always into something. Wow. My dad always says, why can't you just stop? And I don't know why I can't stop. I'm habitually in looking for the next kind of thing to do. And, I love doing that, and I love sort of sharing that with the kids. And I've got my oldest son's now old enough to start to understand the numbers and the finances, and it's like super exciting for me to like go through all the, in the same way that I'm excited to talk to Sterling about horses, I'm excited to talk to him about our next vacation property and how it's going to cash flow and whether we're going to make it, or that stuff's great and fun for me. So and my wife is also really, really good at interior design. I'm terrible at that. And she's really good at kind of making the interior something special on a budget. And, she does such a good job with it that it makes all my projects look much more put together than they otherwise would. And they've been much more successful because of it. So.
Wow. I love it. I love a good entrepreneur, Karen.
Oh, I know.
I should
start
an entrepreneurial podcast because I love to listen to people's stories.
There you go.
I love it.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun, but it's not for the faint of heart. It feels about like starting Rolex. A lot of days, you're like, how on earth am I going to pull all this together, and is this going to work? And if it doesn't work, then I'm going to be completely destitute. It's the same feeling of excitement. And then when you come through the finish flags, it feels amazing. But it's not for everybody. Because it's the roller coaster. You think that, you can be at the top of the roller coaster and things can go bad pretty quickly. So, and you only eat what you hunt and kill. So, so I love it. I wouldn't have it I couldn't have it any other way. I don't think I'm built to do any other kind of work. It's the only thing I don't have the ability to turn that off. So, I wouldn't be happy working for anybody else or having a normal sort of job. I'd have to do lots of things. It's a function of my attention deficit, I think.
Oh, I think that's a superpower. I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I mean, I really do. I really think that's like a superpower. Like the fact that we're not all designed to work for people. And that's really cool. I admire that a lot. So I could pick your brain on that all day long. So, but I can't, Karen.
No, you
There's
can't.
Other business
no,
to be done.
So as we wind things down, Michael, do you have any advice for that young rider trying to make it in this sport?
Yeah, I would say the most important thing is to watch a lot of really good people and figure out what they're doing that you're not doing. And part of that is, like, I think that it's much easier to go to somebody and ask them for help if you can assess yourself well. I see that a lot of times with people when they ask me things, like they're kind of not totally understanding what they're, and it doesn't mean that you're going to always understand, but like when you can tell when somebody comes to talk to you and wants help and they really understand where they need to do better. Or even if they don't understand, like you can see that they're really trying to understand what makes somebody better than them. I think that's a really endearing quality, and it helps you find the right people that will help you. I just remember watching hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of tapes, and like really caring about like why some people just consistently were at the top of the sport on every kind of horse. And that was what was fascinating, not who was winning my local show. Like none of that mattered to me, who was actually winning or the people that I was competing with, whether they were beating me, none of that mattered. Like what mattered to me was like, how do I ride like these people that are so amazing and seem like they can get on any horse? And because I kind of started to understand what was consistent, then in a way he thought, oh, okay, this kid kind of has it and he'll help me. Like I had to have some talent, but I also had to have the ability to be, you know, self, to recognize where I really needed help and to kind of go after that. And, you know, understanding some parts of the history of the sport. I mean, all those things are really important. If you really want to be great. And then the next thing I would say is that, that being great at anything helps you be great at whatever you want to do. And, that it's really important that if you learn how to be great in one area, that you can figure out how to apply that to other parts of your life and to be okay when the time comes, if you do need to move on. Like I really struggled with that. And my life is fantastic now. Like, you know, and I get to still do horses and I don't look at any of the time that I spent with horses as anything but fantastic education for what I now do. And I think you have to be, and I've had a number of students that have come to me that their parents kind of came to me and said, look, like I love horses, but I want them to go to college and run a business or whatever it was. And I've had a couple that have gone on to do really cool things like that as well. And I was comfortable talking to them about, you know, that horses may not be the final path for them, but don't think of it as failure, you know? It's really about self-growth and figuring out what you need to do and what's best for you. And then learning from every opportunity that you get, I guess, is my advice.
Wow. Yeah. Excellent advice.
Very good advice.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. So we'll start winding things down. Just, we know that you're not full-time into horses, but do you still carry any sponsors or have any supporters that you'd like to shout out?
No, not really. Other than my dad who works in the summer heat while I get to go look at all kinds of properties all over the country, and he's building rings at 70 years old in 100 degrees with a shovel. So I guess Future Track, because Jack needs jobs in the Northeast. It's not so hard.
I should made a website. Jack needs jobs. In the Northeast. How do people follow along? Is that like if the websites for the business, like how do people find the Future Track or any of the other businesses?
honestly, he doesn't want anybody else to find him. We have a website. I haven't been on it forever. It's Future Track Arenas, I believe. And that's so funny because, honestly, he does a fantastic job and he is so meticulous and doesn't ever want someone not to be happy. And so we have more jobs than we could do just by word of mouth. So if I get anybody else to call him, he every single year he tells me this is his last year and he's going to retire. And yet he does more every single year. So if I have any extra people call him, he'll probably shoot me. So
so when you call and tell him you heard of Michael on immediately give any podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
That'd be a quick way to get him to retire.
Yeah, exactly.
Or cut off ties with you.
He keeps saying, he says, you spoiled rich boy, when do I get to move to Montana? I haven't moved to Montana, Pops. I'm just, I'm going, after I'm done with this call, I'm going to do some roofing on one of the houses. So I always make sure that I send him some job that's is hot and hard. And so he feels like that he's not the only one.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's really cool. Aww. Well, awesome. Well, and if you have business venture ideas, Michael's your guy.
Contact there you Michael. Go.
It sounds like you're in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very cool.
Yeah, I'm always, I'm in.
Awesome. Well, Karen, was this fantastic?
This was great. Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining us. It's been our pleasure having you on. It was great to get to know you and hopefully we get to see you around out there.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. I really appreciate what you guys are doing for the sport and happy to help any way I can. I'm you know, I love the sport has done so much for me. I mean, you know, everything I have in business, everything that I do and have done has come really from my start in horses. And I still love it. I'm still super passionate about it. I always think about, you know, when Rolex comes around, I try not to even go because it makes me miss it too badly. But it's just such a wonderful sport, and I love the people in it, and I love to be a part of it. So thanks for helping bring it together. Because you know, there's always this feeling sometimes of upper level versus lower levels, and ultimately we're all just horse lovers, and you know, I just love people at all levels of the sport because they're generally some of the best people I've ever met.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and never miss an episode of the Major League Eventing Podcast.